Healthy Dose is a bi-weekly podcast hosted by Steve Krause, healthcare partner at Bessemer Venture Partners, and Trevor Price, CEO of Oxygen Partners and general partner of Town Hall Ventures. The guys talk to leaders from various aspects of healthcare and cover personal stories, entrepreneurship, investing, and have a few laughs, many at each other's expense.
So for podcast listeners, Steve loves the news panel.
I love the news panel.
You love bringing together the variety of people.
I do.
Throwing out some questions.
I do.
The read of like, what's the biggest news of the year?
I didn't talk about funding this time, though. I didn't say, oh, it's way overcapitalized.
Really?
Did I?
No, maybe not.
Okay.
We had a good one today. We had Kyle Armbruster, who's really considered
guy.
One of the superstars at Athena, who's now running Signify Health, which is an HRA care management business, actually backed by another one of our guests, Matt Holt, who's literally one of my favorite guys in the industry.
Yeah,
favorite
I've never met Matt
with.
Before.
Incredible. Runs healthcare at New Mountain.
Really smart. Guy knows healthcare and really thoughtful.
And then Chrissy, I think, honestly, like, you know when people on the Today Show, like someone goes on vacation and they bring in, Lester Holt steps in to coach.
Love
That's
Lester.
Chrissy.
Yeah.
Like, if like you and I ever wanted to like not do a podcast,
right.
like, we couldn't
well,
make
I'm,
one
I'm,
of the recordings.
I'm talking to Chrissy on the side. You might get cut out.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah, it might be the Chrissy and Steve show soon.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm getting the boot.
She's a pretty good podcast. Like, she's like our, she's like the 3P podcast.
Yeah, yeah. And then we're at Bill Geary and Robert Mittendorf's.
This is their show, the Digital Health Innovation Summit. Robert is one of the smartest venture capitalists I know. He's a doctor. And so I just always find him to be very, very thoughtful. I think it shows through here. He's very thoughtful about the industry and about how things play out in the industry. So I thought it was good.
So we had a private equity guy, a
VC
venture
guy.
Person, an entrepreneur, CEO. And
my soon-to-be podcast fellow host.
It was a good one.
Yeah. Hope you enjoy. All right. Well, we're rolling. Trevor, we haven't done one of these in a while. This is, we like to do these. These are sort of what we call our news panel podcast. We have four illustrious guests with us. Thanks for coming. We want to sort of talk about the last 6 months. So I'll start the first question and anyone feel free to answer. What do you think the biggest story or event in our industry has been in 2018?
I mean, I'll start. I think actually probably the biggest event for me is seeing non-traditional players making bigger bets in healthcare. So, I mean, Chrissy's talked about it a bunch, but I think clearly putting $1 billion on PillPack is huge. I think we're seeing the Amazon, JP Morgan triumvirate as a big move. And I think we're seeing lots of other non-traditional healthcare companies starting to think very seriously about what they can do and putting money behind it from pharma to the consumer side.
Why is this time different for that, do you think? You would have said that, 10 years ago, right? Apple was doing stuff, Microsoft, Google. What makes this time different, or is it not?
I'd say a couple things. I think the gap between the consumer experience with technology and media and the consumer experience with healthcare is greater than it's ever been. And people are just fed up. Employers are also fed up as well, and that's beginning to emerge. And I'd say that the last thing is that you are starting to see some regulatory changes which are evolving the model towards value. And as money flows, the industry is restructuring around some of those regulations.
Is the idea of that being that value therefore means that the consumer's got to be involved in their healthcare if you're going to actually get value out of the system?
Yes. Value is a proxy for alignment across the whole system. The patient ultimately is going to be the center of the system. It's still a long ways away. So there are companies and organizations, resetting and reforming, their strategies around that overall direction.
I want to actually go back to Robert for a second and just double click on both of those. Those are both, you mentioned Amazon buying PillPack and you mentioned JP Morgan, Berkshire Hathaway, Amazon partnership. Are those real events or like Amazon buying PillPack is a, it's like a day of annual operating income for that company. And so far the Berkshire Hathaway, JP Morgan, Amazon platform is a lot of PR, but we haven't really seen anything out of it. And so if those are major events, are those major events that are foreshadowing something that's happening in the future, or do you see those as actual tangible events this year?
If you're asking me, I would say yes, they are. Certainly for a company the size of Amazon, that's not even a rounding error, but I think it's a bet into a space. Obviously, they've done a lot of other work in the space in terms of getting distribution licenses at the state level for all kinds of things.
I would also say that, you know, while we haven't seen them execute on PillPack, like we don't know exactly how they're going to use the asset, Amazon knew when they bought the company that there was going to be a massive reaction in healthcare because already, you know, just when I was writing stories about things they were doing and thinking about at CNBC, you would see these healthcare stocks react and suddenly you were the CEO of a major drugstore company like a Walgreens and you'd be on your earnings call and people would be asking you, like, what's your reaction to Amazon? And so these people had to think about what they were going to do to this sort of march of the Amazon disruption. And I think a lot of things have actually happened on the healthcare side just in reaction to that, which, like, is amazing given
that
Amazon's barely done anything yet. But that in and of itself seems to me disruptive. And I don't think it would be happening if these healthcare companies could say we actually have a great consumer experience and we are beloved in the marketplace. And the fact that they're already reacting suggests to me that they know they aren't.
We're recording this at the Digital Health Innovation Summit in Boston. And just yesterday, the DOJ approved the Anthem-CVS merger. Aetna. Right. I was saying after Cigna and Anthem broke up. We had Humana break up with Aetna. Now there's still talk about Humana and Walmart. What's happening? We don't think that's all big news in 2018. Those are some massive moves compared to, no offense to PillPack or Berkshire Hathaway, JP Morgan, Amazon, but like those are multi-billion dollar mergers of just titans in the industry. What do we think is happening there?
Well, actually, I totally agree with that, but I think that's a little bit more predictable. And I think those are going to create much more of a short-term impact than Amazon will. I think those mergers are massive, and obviously if Walmart and Humana get connected, you have a huge amount of synergy there in the Medicare Advantage market that you'll see. Actually, I think that one is probably the most profound for me.
Which one, Walmart, Humana?
Yeah, if that happens, I think because you have the number two player in Medicare Advantage market and you have Walmart with all the prescription possibilities there, plus a very well-defined consumer brand, albeit losing to Amazon in a number of areas. But I think that is probably...
Plus the retail presence.
Right. So I think that is more traditional. But what kind of excites me is non-traditional companies with a lot of horsepower, and I don't think they're playing around with it. I think they are, and when I say non-traditional in terms of healthcare IT and services, companies like Roche and Amazon moving into this space, and I think a small way for them, but big way for us.
What's it say about the fundamentals of being a payer in this country, right? You have the big four trying to merge, everyone's trying to catch up with United Optum. United Optum's effectively figured out how to shift a lot of their economics out of the health plan and into the services side. You're buying PBMs. It's saying something about the future of being a major payer in this industry, I would think, right?
I would say this. I think all of these industry events are all correlated with each other. We led with the comments around Amazon, Berkshire, JP Morgan, you know, raised the flag and said, we're not happy with the status quo. You know, many other large employers are saying the same thing, including Walmart. That's absolutely been a driver for, you know, this increased consolidation and the tectonic shifts playing. I think that if you just take a step back and look at the stock prices of all the major health plans over the past, you know, 8-10 years, it's been a very good run.
Yeah.
It's been a very good run on the back of, in particular, Medicare Advantage, which is a regulated market. And ultimately, costs need to come out of the system, which is in part, I believe, why some of these mergers are actually happening. Some of these players are trying to get ahead of what is going to be, you know, continued cost pressure from the employers, but ultimately from the government as well.
And so they're running to pharmacy because it's 24-25% of total spend, right? And is that
right? Like, how does Aetna CVS drive costs out of the system?
They're looking to integrate what's ultimately a big PBM with a health plan. And these are both middlemen that are coming together in the context of now employers trying to create pressure. What I think Aetna sees is Aetna has struggled for years with their relationship with the consumer, which does not exist. I mean, when we talk to health plan executives through our companies, everybody recognizes that, you know, health plans are not thought of very well in the patient and consumer market. And so that's ultimately what Aetna is trying to get closer to, is get closer to the patient. I think that's ultimately the strategic direction that deal is meant to go in. And then ultimately, they'll be looking to take costs out by integrating pharmacy, PBM, and insurance.
I would say two things. First of all, I am short middlemen. So I think PBMs are in trouble.
Well, so why hasn't anybody disrupted the PBM?
They are. They will. I mean, actually, that's what I think is the most interesting part of the Amazon, Berkshire, JP Morgan. It's not care delivery. I think it's the PBM model, which I think is problematic. But to Chrissy's point, I think, and I've seen this personally, I mean, you know, I'm at a great firm. My deductible has gone up probably 500%.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And so, and I luckily can afford that. But if you take a consumer that was used to a $25 copay,
that's a huge difference.
And you take it to $2,000,
sure.
I feel like, Trevor, they will start to
care.
Mm-hmm. And even though they're not going to understand, hell, most of us in the room don't really understand everything about the RCM aspects of our healthcare. I think there are opportunities there, and I think that they're going to have to learn because
well,
it's a big purchase.
Agree. I totally agree that money drives there. I mean, you said it, Matt, right off the top, right? It's all about money in healthcare, unfortunately. And the fact that Amazon chose prescription drugs, to my mind, is not a coincidence. One is they can deliver it to the home, but secondly, it's first dollar healthcare.
Yeah.
Yep. First time every consumer experiences the copay is when they go to the pharmacy, right? Because most people are on multiple meds, and they're like, "Oh shit, I gotta pay," you know, what you said, a couple $100 to pay for this. What the heck? How's that possible, right? Yeah. And so I think that's why Amazon went there, is because that's the most consumer experience. You know, that's first dollar healthcare in my mind.
But they also bought Whole Foods, and that could be a healthcare play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but you know it's unclear. It depends on how they want to make money through that asset. Is it going to come through big food, or are they going to start thinking in really interesting ways?
I think they're going to put pharmacies. Like if I were them, I'd load pharmacies in there, like a physical pharmacy, personally. But I'm not them.
There's no reason you couldn't deliver pill pack esque pharmaceuticals into an Amazon locker if you had the right regulatory controls.
Yeah.
There's no reason that they couldn't use Whole Foods with a modest footprint, not like Walmart or Walgreens. I think Walgreens has like 8,000 locations now, but you at least start to play in that game.
Yeah.
You mentioned the retail front, and I think that shouldn't be shortchanged. I mean, it's ironic. The advisory board, for 5 years at least, has been publishing the same report that basically says that the overwhelming majority of healthcare spend is dictated by two things. It's not quality. It's not the pedigree of the doctor. It's convenience and access, right? And to Matt's point, getting close to these members, these consumers, these individuals in a way where they're walking into Walmarts and CVSs constantly, and in our case, going into the home.
I actually saw a study recently that was looking at this whole new emerging area that Lyft and Uber are basically trying to get into, this NEMT,
NEMT.
Market.
Yeah.
And like one of the reasons why it wasn't as effective as we thought isn't because like these rides weren't working, it's because people still didn't want to go. Like even if you make it a little bit more convenient, they still don't want to go walk into an experience that they know is going to be sitting around in a waiting room for 45 minutes, like uncomfortable, not knowing who you're going to see, and then you see someone for 5 minutes who makes you feel like crap.
No one said Apple. We haven't talked about Apple. I mean, like, you know, they just came out with the ECG watch, right? Got a lot of press to it. They're doing stuff on the PHR space for sure, right? Do we believe Apple's going to be a player here?
Yes, the watch is the tip of the spear there for them. I think you're going to see that. My view is it's going to take some time. The rest of the market ecosystem needs to evolve before Apple can have a play, ultimately. Data is interesting, it's helpful, but if we look at the healthcare system and we look at where the costs are, it's not people who are wearing Apple Watches.
Yeah.
And coming back to the money point, if you just look at where the costs are, look at the demographics, look at where the money is going, look at where the regulators are all focused, they're not Apple consumers. They're retirees of auto plants who live in Ohio who have advanced onset disease. Apple's not going to touch that market. Amazon might. And so as you look at where the costs are,
Walmart definitely
does.
And Walmart has those folks. I mean, they have probably the best, you know, touch point of anybody, absolutely. I think Apple's far away from really where the costs are.
Robert, you made a lot of money in wearables, or you know, wearable monitoring, right? Yeah. So, what's your view on?
So, we were investors in Basis, sold to Intel, and Misfit, sold to Fossil, and
iRhythm is a monitoring device, right?
iRhythm, which is a clinical wearable, if you will.
Right.
You know, my view as a physician is, and I think what Apple's doing with the FDA is great. I mean, they went there, they have a classification for the device, they can drop apps on it now, but to be frank, that's kind of interesting, but that's not core to healthcare delivery. I think Apple, they're going to be in the wearable market. That's great. I don't feel like the price point of that device is not going to work in the Walmart type population, which is where all the costs are. I also think, you know, they purchased Glimpse, which got them the
PHR
part. But really, that's from the front end of healthcare.
Yep.
And so I think Glimpse was an interesting way of getting some data. You can get medication lists, problem lists, but as a physician, it's not the level of detail I would need to actually deliver care. And so I think that's going to be a limitation for Apple until that information gets to HealthKit. I think once it's there, the challenge is, well, then how do you monetize that? Because then you have the provider side you still have to enable. So I think Apple's interesting, but I don't feel like the strategy is at least as well articulated as some of these other players.
Does Apple buy a telemedicine company next? Because, I mean, I think a lot of the fears that you hear from cardiologists, especially around this EKG, is what if I end up with a bunch of paranoid Apple Watch users in my practice where nothing's actually wrong with them? So does there need to be some kind of digital layer in between? And you saw Apple with the heart study working with Amwell, and they don't tend to work with partners for very long before they convert to doing their own thing. Mm-hmm. So I wonder when that's going to happen, if it's going to happen.
That would make a lot of sense, actually.
I've been mocked on this podcast multiple times by saying, why doesn't Amazon build a telemed platform? And now you do a diagnosis, you have medical supplies, you have pharmacy, you do your prescription through the Amazon platform. It's like you're a Prime member, but I think Apple could do the same thing.
I would say my only concern about an Apple doing that is twofold. One is, if you listen to Apple earnings call, they're a device company, and they're largely a phone company. So, you know, 70 or so percent of the revenue is actually devices. They come up with new devices all the time. They're incrementally more innovative than the last, but they're a device company. Their content business is a fraction of their revenue. So even, you know, iTunes is growing, but it's still very, very small. So they are still a consumer-focused device company. I think taking on that risk on the services side and then taking on the regulatory risk of managing a practice is a big strategic shift for them. So I think it's unlikely, but who knows?
Hey, we sort of skirt around policy. I'm curious, you know, when we did this, Chrissy, probably a year ago, we were all talking about Trump Care. What Trump's care is going to be, how's it going to screw with our industry or not, make our industry better. Like, what is Trump Care today? Like, what's your guys' analysis of where we are on the policy front?
Having been down to D.C. a few times in the past number of months, you know, what we do see is a business mindset making its way into the policymaking.
A business mindset.
I definitely agree. And the headline level, which is bombastic and controversial, you know, is what it is. You know, at the level where things are getting done and decisions are being made on a discrete policy basis, we are certainly seeing some red tape being torn up, and we're seeing...
What's an example of that, just out of curiosity?
There's efforts to streamline process. You're seeing a lot of discussion around the FDA with respect to drug approvals. You're seeing faster timelines, more business-friendly approaches, really with an effort to get drugs to market sooner. So that would be one example.
Yeah, I agree with that.
You're also seeing it in the discussions around things like data. Interoperability is a very big topic, and there's a big effort to open up data liquidity. We'll see what the regulations end up looking like, but there's going to be a lot of news coming out of the government that is intended to open up access to data at the federal level.
Kyle, you have a lot of experience in this space. I mean, this term interoperability has been used for a decade, right? Epic is the foe of interoperability. What does it look like when interoperability is achieved?
I think to Matt's point, I think the first, it's like going to Alcoholics Anonymous, like you need to accept first, like the reality. And the first acceptance, I think, that's happened in DC, even from a lot of the great folks that built the High Tech Act, was meaningful use accomplished a lot. But we can all agree that it created data silos that were totally shelled off, walled off from being able to move information between different places. Big failure, big lacking thing that's currently in place. So that was a big first step. I think the other thing that the administration finally got this round, and SEMA just came out with it at HIMSS, Jared Kushner's been involved, like the whole executive branch has been pushing it. And it's not about FHIR, it's not about Argonaut, it's not about HL7, it's not about all these standards. Get the incentives in place, let the market move. And they've been talking about really disruptive stuff.
Incentives in this context means what?
Carrots and sticks, right? If you're a health system that is hoarding data from consumers and there's a whistleblower hotline, you should pay millions of dollars, right? And I'll give you a great example. Had my twins here at Man's Greatest Hospital, the whole network and partners. And I'm a healthcare data expert as compared to the regular consumer. And it was an act of God to get out of the system, to go get our kids to a regular pediatrician, because we're in this massive referral chain. But to get their images, their charts out, I physically got them on paper finally at the end.
Absolutely.
Despite knowing that there was plenty of clean ways for them to push it out. But that's normal, right? oh, Kyle, isn't it, if you just stay with our radiology department, or if we just go over to our pediatrician, it's easy. It just, it flows on Epic. It's sitting here. Why wouldn't you just stay a network? And then you go through the whole referral chain again. There's really perverse incentives, and for unsophisticated consumers, right, they feel trapped.
Is this a health system thing, or is this an Epic thing? Because, right, all of that's obviously... I agree with everything you just said. That's coming from an Athena executive whose number one battle against Epic was Epic controls all the data, eliminates interoperability, doesn't actually have open APIs for the most part, is a culture that is exclusive, not inclusive, whereas Athena was trying to, as Jonathan always said, liberate the data.
Yep.
So how much of that is Judy Faulkner and her approach to data versus... you know, the people at Mass General or the people, you know, at the health systems?
I think they're probably both a little complicit. And I think the major actor that you have to push on is the health system. They're dictating their business model at the end of the day. Does Epic help facilitate that and encourage that? Absolutely.
So just out of interest, do you think Judy responds to the demands of the health system by controlling the data, or do you think she controls the data as a business person?
I think the former. I think the health systems are largely... dictating that they want this walled off.
Do you guys all agree with that?
I actually agree with that.
Yeah. Actually, I think it's both. I mean, I'm an Epic user, right? It's hard as hell to get stuff out of Epic. I think the government's approach is to say, how do we force the market the way we want it to go without, you know, doing something truly unnatural? And it's kind of like the High Tech Act. We will pay the customer.
Yeah.
So here we're going to penalize the customer.
Right.
And they're going to force the vendor to share data. I think they both are complicit. I think like Apple. I mean, I love Apple. I have all their consumer products, but I can't move music around. Right. So I now have Spotify. Right. They're definitely complicit, but I think you couldn't force vendors unless you force the consumer.
What I've seen, the government is trying to figure out how to leverage market forces to open up this infrastructure, to modernize it. And I don't think interoperability gets solved until the overall value chain for the data is recognized and addressed. And you know, I keep coming back to, what's the economic value of the data and who actually will pay the most for it? And you know, I would point to Roche Flatiron to point out to dollar value per longitudinal medical record history.
It was like 60 grand per chart, right? Or something like that?
Yes. 20,000 longitudinal records for 2.1 billion. That's the data. And so if the government can figure out how to leverage the money that's sitting in the pharma space, and by the way, the money that's sitting in the health plan industry, because the health plans actually, they have all the data. They have more aggregated data than anybody realizes. Leveraging those market forces to subsidize the modernization of the underlying infrastructure is ultimately a model that will open up the data access. Because my view is that consumers will never pay for it, and the hospitals just don't have the money.
I have a question. It's sort of a two-part question. One, does this idea of interoperability mean that there may be a new entrant in the EMR space, which kind of to this point has been thought of like a dead on arrival?
Would you back that company?
Well, secondly, and this is maybe for you, you talked to a lot of these companies. back to our earlier conversation about some of these more tech companies, is a tech company going to come in and buy an Athena, an Epic, a Cerner? So does this like idea of liquidity in the market allow for new entrants into the EMR space? Or do we think we're just going to have a world 10 years from now where it's Epic, Cerner, Athena, and maybe a few other sort of vertically focused?
Being out in Silicon Valley, I meet 5 or 6 people in the tech world every year who want to start a new EMR. And typically their thinking is that there's no one smart in healthcare. And so they're the first one that's come along with this idea. And so I just sit and I listen and I say good luck. And most... I mean, if not all of them, within 6 months, have a pivot. So I don't know, is that even possible? Could there be a new EMR company? And it seems like everyone just gives up.
Well, I mean, I think there are 3 things. I think it's really hard. First of all, there's a data network effect that is not helped by the lack of data liquidity. So as a physician, I can't have the last month of data on you to treat you properly. I need the last couple of years. Fair. If that's locked behind a wall, good luck switching that. Number 2 is you've already trained a whole cadre of providers on a system. That's a huge investment of time. I've been involved in 2 Epic rollouts, very painful, but at the end of 6 months, you're actually more efficient, but it takes a lot of effort. And 3 is, this is a very state industry that focuses on brand and who else has the software. So you're fighting 3 really big forces. Could it be done? Sure. I don't think you will have anything done until the data is liquid.
Do you think a tech company comes and buys one of these companies?
Why same 10 companies? Athena? I mean, why hasn't that happened? And wouldn't they have done that by now?
Why haven't they bought Athena?
I don't know. I mean, it made sense to me that an Amazon or an Apple would look at that asset. I'm sure they've looked. Even Microsoft, it would make sense.
Yeah.
But I don't know why that hasn't happened. It could have been some of the controversy.
What about Salesforce? I mean, Salesforce made their big splash on their health cloud, which was nothing. It doesn't seem like it's much more than a splash a couple years ago, right? There's not a lot there. Like, why wouldn't, I mean, they would be in the position. You right off the top of this, Matt, you talked about consumer experience and customer relationships. And so Salesforce is in a unique position to try to bring those two things together.
It makes sense. I mean, every few years, someone comes to me and says, I think Microsoft is going to buy Cerner. So, you know, there could be some type of consolidation like that happens at some point, but it just hasn't yet, and I don't know why.
I'd make the point that the big need in the market right now is optimizing payment and its revenue cycle management. And so which of these companies are EMRs, which of these companies are really actually revenue cycle management companies?
That's really
optimizing dumb. Payment. And that's what, when you go sit down with doctors and hospital systems, they are really struggling from an economic standpoint. They just want to get paid, and the payment
Especially
systems are broken.
Side.
My view is that the companies that we're talking about that will be successful will be the ones that recognize that that's where the real value is, and that's what will drive revenue growth. That's what will drive aggregation of data, and the unlocking of that data as a value matter will become a second or third order matter. But right now, the pain point in the market is getting paid. And that's what Athena has been doing really well. And you know, I look at Athena and say, it just needs to be recapitalized. It is a growing business.
I agree.
The customers are happy.
That thing could be a cash cow.
It was built on really good bones. There are still a lot of really good people there. You know, it just needs to be recapitalized. And being public with the circumstances that have played out has been difficult from a corporate brand standpoint. But you know, the customers are still there, and ultimately, it just needs a refresh. And it's a great problem.
Refresh or turnaround?
A refresh. The business is growing. It's not a restructuring. It's not a steel company with high cost infrastructure. It's a growing business with an attractive market position built on, you know, modern technology. So it's still well positioned relative to the overall industry landscape, which is marked by old legacy maintenance models. A lot of big providers built their own EMR systems. Those are the ones that need to be upgraded and replaced.
Our whole product roadmap when I left in April was focused on rev cycle expansion. I mean, it was basically, rev cycle was really sexy and everyone cared about it. And then high tech came, everyone kind of forgot about it because government pumped $50 billion into what Jonathan famously called cash for clunkers, which it absolutely was, just getting a bunch of unconnected medical records stood up. When you step back and look at what they are, they're all billing medical records.
Totally. So
it is all about code capture, ICD-10.
Totally.
It's not about physician satisfaction. It's not about patient data liquidity. And I do absolutely believe rev cycle is back in vogue, because what happened during that high-tech period, people took their eye off the rev cycle ball. BPOs continued to grow internal to health systems. You saw partners just outsource coding finally to India. Right? They couldn't keep sustaining all this cost. And the real winners in this space, I think, will continue to expand rev cycle services to take more of that cost structure out and to run them at big economies of scale.
I just want to point out that we started out talking about Apple Watches doing EKGs and cool.
We're talking about coding outsourcing.
What we just heard is that revenue cycle is in vogue. Right? That's the sexy thing. All right, Chrissy, no one listens to this thing, so you can be fully transparent with us. And what are you working on? Like, what stories are you chasing these days?
Well, there are a few new areas that I think are really interesting, that sometimes I have these like strategic focus areas that I think if I were a big tech company, I would be looking at these areas, and sometimes it pans out and sometimes it doesn't. This isn't particularly sexy, but I do think aging tech is one of those areas.
Yeah.
We didn't talk about this, but I think another reason that Silicon Valley is interested in healthcare is because they're looking at their own demographics and saying, we have a group of users that are getting older, sicker, and richer, and we can't continue to just be focusing on the millennials. We're going to lose out on this huge market. So now you're seeing, you know, Apple with fall detection. Google Nest is looking to get into senior living facilities. One of Amazon's top lieutenants, one of the first things he did when he got to Amazon is he got on a bus tour around America to visit different aging elderly facilities and meet with experts in the space and figure out what Amazon's strategy could be. So that's an area I think I should be, you know, covering more.
You were just mentioning aging, and you were talking about, let's not just focus on the millennials, but the youth in America seem unwell these days.
Social media.
Social media, depression, anxiety.
Vaping.
Vaping.
Any jewel investments around the table.
Right? you know, addiction.
Yeah.
We've talked in this podcast about the importance of behavioral health care and why behavioral health care is a driver as well as a comorbid case. Like, the youth in our country are not well from a behavioral health care standpoint.
Have you guys,
like, what are we doing about
ever
that?
Seen a venture-backed teen health company? Because I haven't. Why aren't there more of these companies? I mean, certainly we've been talking about women's health now, finally, and that's an area we're starting to see investment, but I don't see anything in children's or teens' health.
Well, we're an investor in Talkspace, which is text-based, video, and audio-based therapy, and I'll speak to that point in a second. They just rolled out in a very limited fashion to teens, and that there was a lot of regulatory issues we had to work through to
consent.
Do that. Parental consent was a big one, because you have to allow confidentiality, but you can breach that sometimes if necessary, if there's, you know, suicidal ideation, et cetera. But I think to your point, I think the millennials are a very interesting healthcare consumer, because they've come into a market, they basically went from zero to $2,000 deductible, and they are not used to sitting and waiting in an
office. I totally agree with that.
And so what I saw with Talkspace, which I was very skeptical about when we first saw the investment, was, wait a minute, people are on this service for an average of 12 months texting a therapist. Who is doing this? And when you look at the metrics of that company and you look at the satisfaction and you look at the clinical scores, and I'm not giving them an ad here, I mean, it's before pre-diligence, PHQ-9 and GAD-7 and GAD-8 scores, which are anxiety and depression respectively scores, they show differences. Wow. If you try to go to a therapist, people drop after 3 or 4 visits because you're leaving work every Wednesday and your boss knows you're doing something strange, right? So I think there's stigma, access, and costs that drive that. But the millennials are a very unique consumer. You're looking at companies like Hims.
Yeah, I was just going to say Hims. I mean, if you look at Hims, Nurx, Lemonade, from a financial perspective, it makes no sense. People are paying premium pricing for generics.
Yep.
But the reason they're doing it is because they don't, to your point earlier about cost, it's access, really.
It's access,
they don't have to go to CVS and pick up a drug and have that embarrassing moment, right?
They're on like, Instagram, you click the button,
right,
it orders, and it comes.
But you look at it as like, it actually makes no sense from a financial perspective,
yeah,
right? Because you're paying more for generic drugs that you probably could even get like for less than a dollar, right?
I don't understand how like no regulatory agencies on, especially on the state level, have come down on those companies.
On Hims.
Because I, just to be honest with you guys, I was looking into Hims and I pretended to be a middle-aged man and I bought ED drugs very easily. And the all I got was like
that's
some
what you've
kind
been
of.
Up to.
Yeah, anyway, that's a story that Chris has written.
Yeah. I probably
really,
should write
you're
that.
You're lucky
up.
That no one listens to this.
Yeah. It was too easy. And the only thing I got was some, like, it seemed like some chat body type message from some physician that was like, if you have any questions, but it didn't even seem like a real doctor. And I just wonder how that's going to be interpreted, because I know that we want to make it easy for people to buy these medications, but this is a symptom, typically, or it could be, of some bigger medical problem.
Yeah.
And so we need a physician relationship. And I think a lot of these companies that are targeted at millennials want to make the process very automated and easy, but they're taking this idea of a physician relationship and they're making it very thin, very loose. And I don't know how that's going to play out.
Yeah.
I mean, Trevor, you brought up, I mean, I have a 6-year-old daughter, so I'm not in the 9-year-old group yet, but and luckily she's not on devices in any way yet. But I think there would be a number of things we don't understand yet in that generation that will come out in health costs later. Just like, you know, cigarette smoking in generations past resulted in large costs later. I mean, I think Juul is a good example of something that was kind of irresponsible, which could have affected that generation in a much greater way than hopefully it will.
It's still TBD.
The addiction rates are off the
charts. And just social media in general.
Screen addiction.
Yeah, I think social media and FOMO and anxiety and like social anxiety are, I think this population is going to really struggle with that.
Those are going to be the big issues, absolutely. Yeah.
I just took a 4-month break from Instagram and I'm finding like I'm shopping differently. I spent my vacation not taking photos. I mean, it was just like all these things manifested in my behavior. And I realized that my brain was being addled by...
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah. And when you realize that you're being manipulated like that, something, a light bulb goes off. But I don't think most people take the time to take that break.
I have one question.
Is it around IRR? Are you going to, this is your IRR question?
Okay. Well, I mean, we just talked about earlier about how one of the greatest entrepreneurs in our space, Jonathan Bush, sort of got taken down.
Yeah.
And Athena is on, you know, rough waters right now. Like, a shitload of money is being poured in the sector, right? Raquel just said it now is $6.8 billion, already surpassed 2017 through 3 quarters. Like, where the hell are the exits? Like, where's the IPOs? Where are they?
I don't know that I mean, we were talking about this the other day, Matt and I, if you look at the number of public companies in 2008, it was 8,000 or so. Public companies today, 3,500. I think there's more money.
You just think IPOs are gone in general?
I just think it's bigger and bigger private entities are getting pulled together, and there's a lot more flexibility and creativity and long-term view that can come from that. I mean, I left a very large public company, right? And right. went into the private space. And it's so much more calm and rational than this quarterly kind of death march with make-believe numbers that you're doing the best you can to kind of project. And instead, it's a dialogue with empathy and a lot more humanity in it. And you can actually focus on taking really big shots that drive outcomes instead of just incrementalism. So I think that you're going to continue to see a flood of private capital come in and take bigger and bigger things together and figuring out different ways to distribute profits.
You have PillPack, you have GoodRx, One Medical, there was a secondary there, Landmark, these are Aspire. Oak Street Health, Aspire. These are all companies, and many of those companies were built organically. They're not like private equity roll-ups. They're built organically.
That's definitely true.
In 5 years, they're going from startup to 500 to a billion to a billion five in market cap. And they're being bought by really good private equity investors that are going to take them to the next level. And then the question is, does Anthem buy them? Does Optum buy them? Like, where is that exit for the private equity firms?
The public market is in secular decline. Yeah. That's the reality. You have companies staying longer, and by the time they go public, it's become a proxy for that next private round wasn't there.
That's
so
exactly
it's right. become a, and there's become an adverse selection process with the companies that are actually going public. So companies are staying private longer. There's new capital that's coming in new ways. And, you know, SoftBank and the Vision Fund is example A.
Yeah,
totally. So, you know, that's my perspective.
Steve, I would say, I think what you might be asking is, we put 1x capital in, are we going to get 1.2x or 4x
that's
out?
What I'm
I don't
asking.
Think we're going to get 3x out. I hope we have over a 1x out. There's a lot of experimentation in the space. There's a lot of good exits. But can we actually have exits that, you know, meet or beat what we put in? It's hard to say right now. There's a lot of exuberance still in this market.
All right, my final question. I started off with a version of this, but I want each of you to take either one word or one sentence at most, because we're basically almost through 2018. We're like at the end of October. So 2018 will be remembered as what in healthcare? Flushing money down the toilet. Perfect timing.
Giant toilet flush.
That is definitely not getting edited out. No. For those who are wondering, that was a toilet flushing.
Flushing money down the toilet. All right. Who wants to follow that?
Shots fired.
Shots fired. Good or bad shots?
We don't know yet.
Shots fired.
Consumer transforming.
Matt?
Reset.
What do you mean by reset?
I think that the tables are being reset by some of the big deals that we've seen this year. And I think the market will look different going forward.
Renewed focus on elderly, vulnerable care is really starting to catch one. And I think that really picked up steam this year.
All right. It's a wrap.
Great. Thanks very much, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Good one. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to A Healthy Dose. Please subscribe through iTunes, and if you have any suggestions for topics or guests, please tweet us at @ahealthydosepod.